Friday, the White Sox beat Cleveland. It's an afternoon game for the White Sox in Cleveland today. Tonight, the Brewers in St. Louis. The Cubs host Cincinnati again. NBA, Bucks and Bulls off last night. Both teams home tonight. The Bucks host the Celtics. The Bulls host Atlanta. NHL, first-round playoff action. The Blackhawks skate in Nashville tonight. Now the WGTD Wednesday forecast from the National Weather Service. Sunny, breezy, and mild. High today, 60. Right now, wind from the east at 16 miles per hour. 48 degrees Racine, 51 Kenosha, 42 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg, up next.
Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenoshans who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD HD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're going to be exploring a very, very troubling story of gruesome murder centered in the city of Boston back in the mid to late 19th century. The book is called The Wilderness of Ruin, a tale of madness, fire, and the hunt for America's youngest serial killer. It is the story of one infamous young man by the name of Jesse Pomeroy, who was accused of vicious attacks on a number of fellow children and actually sent to a reform school and then discharged prematurely, it would seem. And it is believed went on then to commit two absolutely gruesome, ghastly murders, again, of other children. And this led to his conviction and ultimately to his lifelong imprisonment. It was a story that absolutely terrified the citizens of Boston and New England, and also gathered the attention of a number of important onlookers, including the likes of Oliver Wendell Holmes and the great novelist Herman Melville. This came at a time when there was great fascination in the topic of mental imbalance, mental illness, insanity, and young Jesse Pomeroy seems to have been an example of something gone terribly awry in his young mind and emotional state. And this story has been explored in meticulous detail by a very gifted writer by the name of Roseanne Montillo. She teaches as a professor of literature at Emerson College and is also the author of a book called The Lady and Her Monsters, which, if I remember correctly, is a book which helped serve as a catalyst for the writing of this new book published by William Morrow, again called The Wilderness of Ruin. Roseanne Montillo, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Am I correct about that? Do I remember that? That something about the work you did on that previous book led you to encounter this troubling story of the young Jesse Pomeroy?
Yes, you're right. I was researching that previous book, The Lady and Her Monsters, in the archives of the Harvard University archives, and somehow their search engine for the library brought me to a different collection that I really wasn't looking for, I really didn't need, and it was the collection of Detective James Woods. And he was one of a very famous detective here in Boston in the 1860s, 1870s, and the collection is very, very large, and there was something interesting about him, something very, he seemed like he really enjoyed his work, but also he was fascinated by crime in general, and one of the crimes that really stood out for him was the Jesse Pomeroy crimes, And it sort of sparked my interest as well, because he was so disturbed by him. It seemed very peculiar that someone like him, who had seen so much, would be disturbed by a boy his age.
Hmm. In other words, someone who is, I mean, it's understandable for sort of a normal person living a normal life to be absolutely horrified and thunderstruck
right.
by such deeds. But for an active detective who've seen all kinds of terrible things, the fact that this was so exceptionally disturbing to him says something about the story.
In fact, the detective had seen so much. He had lived through so much. And it sort of dawned on me that it had to be exceptionally horrifying. The crime that Pomeroy had committed had to be so horrible, that Woods had to be so horrified by them for him to really write in such details about him. And it sort of sparked my own curiosity, and it sort of led me down a different path that I hadn't really imagined.
Hmm. How difficult was it to uncover important and verifiable information about Jesse Pomeroy and what he had done and the context in which these crimes were committed? After all, we're talking about events as long ago as the late 1860s.
Right. Jesse Pomeroy is not one of the most well-known individuals in the country, so I had to start from the most reliable places, such as the state archives. And they have all the details of the crimes that he committed. So if you go at the state archives, they have all the judicial records. They have all the papers relating to the trials. They have the information that he told the police as well. But also the Detective Woods has copies of his own interrogations with Pomeroy as well. So I had to sort of set them side by side and make sure that the two were parallel, that the stories were reliable. And also, you'd be surprised, the press was incredibly fascinated by the case as well. Boston had about 250 papers at the time. So they went wild with the information, and they scooped it up and wrote as much as they could. And eventually the story spread from the Boston area to the whole New England area and throughout the country as well. So at the time, in the 1870s, Pomeroy was incredibly famous as well. So the newspaper, there are thousands of newspaper articles written about him as well. And of course, the Department of Corrections has all the papers relating to his incarceration as well.
Hmm. In a case like this, where someone is so infamous, is it a challenge to be picking through accounts that might not be fully accurate, that might in some cases be purposefully written for the sake of sensationalizing something?
Embellished, you mean?
Right, right.
Yes, I mean, it was, because the papers didn't make him out to be, especially physically, more imposing than he was. And if you actually look at the pictures of him, the two don't really match. So it was a little bit of a challenge to find the reality, the real story behind the accounts in the papers. So you had to find people who had actually come across him, who were reliable, such as doctors. You'd find that doctors and psychiatrists, people who had come face to face with him for a more benign purpose, people who wanted to study him, people who didn't really have other intentions, such as gaining fame from their connection with Pomeroy. So their accounts were much more reliable than, say, I don't know, a penny newspaper who wanted to sell thousands of copies.
Hmm.
So those accounts don't always match. So the ones that you'll find at the state archives and, of course, the Department of Corrections, those are the more accurate depiction of Pomeroy.
It's interesting where your book begins, or when your book begins, even though most of the central events that we're talking about in your book occurred back in the late 1860s, early 1870s. Your book actually begins in early August of 1929, a half century after most of these incidents had occurred. It's a very intriguing choice that you make. Tell our listeners what you describe and why you wanted to open your book in this way.
Well, on that day, Pomeroy was finally leaving the state prison, and he was being transferred to a different location. He had spent about 50 years in the state prison, so it dawned on me that even after such a long time had passed, most of the people who had been involved in the case had died already, and he was the only relic from the past, from the 1870s, and still people were very fascinated with him. People remembered what he had done, and that day, the entire Charlestown area where the prison was located was pretty much in an uproar, and I was looking at the pictures, and it dawned on me that even after 50 years, he still managed to be a frightening image for lots and lots of people. And by then, he had become, he was in his late 60s, and still there was this image that people had in their minds that if he had been allowed to sort of walk the streets of Charlestown, he could have done so much damage to the children and everybody else surrounding him. And really, by the time he left, he was just a ghost of the person that he had been as a young boy. Hmm. There was nothing really remaining about him that people could have remembered. And still, they were very much afraid of him.
And it really tells us something about how well-known this name was once upon a time, how infamous. By the way, what is the reason for the title of your book, The Wilderness of Ruin?
Well, Oliver Wendell Holmes wrote about the fire to lots of friends that he had, and he used that description to describe the city during that time, the early 1870s, because in his mind, between the fire and the happenings, the crimes that were going on, for him, the city was in ruin, and he used that line in one of his depictions, and I thought it so well captured the era, it so well captured the city and everything that was happening between the flames and Pomeroy, and it dawned on me that perhaps it would make a startling title and it would really stand out and depict the whole city and the era and Pomeroy and capture the whole thing.
We're speaking with Roseanne Montillo about her book, The Wilderness of Ruin, a tale of madness, fire, and the hunt for America's youngest serial killer, namely Jesse Pomeroy. You describe a childhood for Jesse Pomeroy that was nothing short of horrific in a number of different ways. And I suppose it is not entirely surprising to read that. There are all too many instances of children who are so traumatized, so brutalized as youngsters that they find themselves in a number of ways mentally and emotionally scarred all the rest of their lives. What do you think is most important for us to know about the upbringing of Jesse Pomeroy in terms of how that might have shaped who he came to be?
Well, Jesse didn't suddenly start abusing children out of the blue. He had an incredibly abusive childhood. He was actually born with a small defect in his eye that really made him a target for abuse from his schoolmates, from his father as well. He had what they called an albino eye. It was sort of a mucousy film that made the eye incredibly white. So people were startled when they saw him. They were afraid. They were taken aback. And children at his school really abused him incredibly on a daily basis. They beat him up. They tied him up. They made his life miserable from morning until the afternoon on a daily basis. He went home bleeding day after day after day. And at home, it was no better because his father, who was an alcoholic, he believed that Jesse had been born with the sign of the devil. He believed that Jesse was possessed. So in order to take the devil out of him, he needed to beat him up with a leather belt. And more than once, actually, he enjoyed stripping Jesse completely naked and beat him up. So for all of his young life, he became a target for parents, for children, for his own father. And eventually he did unto others what the things that were done unto him. Hmm. It does not excuse him by any means, but it's not surprising that he found that sort of release that he did.
Hmm. So describe to our listeners the kind of really sadistic acts of torture in which he engaged early on. This is where he first got in trouble with the law.
He did. Early on, he actually started off by killing animals. He started off with his own mother's birds. He killed those as well. As a very young boy, between the ages of 3 and 4, he was found often wandering the streets and killing cats. So that was a sign to many of the neighbors that something was a little bit wrong with this child, although his mother didn't seem to take that under consideration. His mother was the only person who didn't see anything wrong with Jesse. He thought these were just kind of actions from a boy who was being taunted, and he needed a way to release his own anger, and the cats were the ones who were going under, if you will. But eventually, right across the street from, they were living in Charlestown, and across the street, across the river from them, in the city of Chelsea, little children began to describe some horrific experiences that they had been going through. They were talking about a boy who, a very tall boy, someone who was unusually, but these were little children, so to them, all of the boys seemed a little bit older and taller. But they described being approached by someone who gave him candy, who gave him a little bit of money, and then this boy would take them to a very secluded area of the city. And there he would begin to abuse them. He would begin to tie them up to maybe wooden posts. And eventually he would beat them up. He would strip them. And it got progressively worse because he started sexually molesting them as well, cutting them up with a knife. He never went so far as to kill any of those boys, but what he did on them was especially cruel.
It's interesting how as word of these crimes begins to spread amongst the community, various nicknames are coined to describe this mysterious figure, one of them being the Inhuman Scamp. And I think that's so interesting. It helps sort of capsulize the the bewilderment of the public that, you know, how could it possibly be that someone who's a youngster themselves could be engaging in this kind of brutal activity directed against other children?
Yes, it was difficult for many people to believe that a boy could be doing this. They also gave him another nickname called the Red Devil. In their minds, there was no reason for anyone to do these things, so it had to be someone superhuman, someone that came from their imagination. So only a devil could be doing these things. A child, there was no way a child would have such cruelty in their hearts. There was no way that a child, someone who was not really much older, Jesse was only 12 at that time. So a 12-year-old boy couldn't be doing these things. Parents couldn't really understand the cruelty that really exists in children's souls.
As you are describing this crime spree before Jesse Pomeroy has actually been fingered as the most likely culprit, you describe one thing that he was himself doing, and you are suggesting that this may have been an important reason why he found himself engaging in such horrific activities. He was reading quite voraciously what are known as dime novels. For any of our listeners who don't really know what that term refers to, describe what the typical dime novel was and how, in fact, those could have had quite a profound effect on young Jesse.
Dime novels were short publications. They were published on a monthly, sometimes even weekly basis, and they were aimed especially for boys. These were stories of cowboys, detectives. They were incredibly bloody. They had incredibly horrific crimes depicted in them. They were aimed for the 12 to 14-year-old generation. And the children were attracted to them. They were saving their money, the little that they had, to buy them. The whole country was reading them. And lots of people believed that these were not the type of works the children should be reading. In fact, the parents even decided that many parents that they didn't want their children to be reading this, but they were sort of the whole rage in the whole country. And lots of doctors, when they realized that Jesse was reading this, they felt that maybe reading these bloody crimes had some kind of an influence on his mind, and he was just recreating what he had been reading all along, that maybe they had influenced his mind to such an extent. So between his enjoyment for the dime novels and the abuse that he was getting at home, the two of them had fused together, and they had given him the temptation to go out and do the same thing, to see if he could get away with it as well.
Hmm. Ultimately, he is apprehended by the police under the most really strange of circumstances. Explain what happens.
Well, they had moved. His mother had, the Boston Globe got a hold of the story in Chelsea, and they published an article. And the whole state pretty much realized that something horrific was going on, including his mother. She noticed that there were some similarities between the person that these children were describing and her own child. And so she decided that the best thing to do would be to move the whole family to South Boston. Eventually, when they moved there, the same thing started to happen in South Boston. Children were being abused. And one of the children that he abused, a boy named Joseph, he gave the police one a clue that they hadn't had before. He realized that the boy had something wrong with his eye. And so the police started looking for something, for someone with an odd-looking eye. Still, they couldn't find him until Jesse simply walked into the police station. And the first person that he saw was the boy that he had actually just abused. So he pretty much just gave himself up. Eventually, he said that he was just curious to see what was going on inside the police station. But really, you know, there was no reason for him to walk in. He was just curious.
Mm. And it just so happened that he crossed paths with this latest victim.
Yes, he was very smart. He was very detailed in his description. He had managed to get a good look at him, and he was caught.
Well, ultimately, he is dismissed from the reform school to which he is sent after just 2 years. So it is a premature release from this reform school.
Even less.
Mm, and then very soon thereafter, he evidently commits the first of two gruesome murders.
He had been sent to reform school until the age of 18. He was supposed to be there for about 6 years. And his mother was always the only person who believed that Jesse was one of the kindest, sweetest boys on the planet. And she believed that if she could only have him in her house, as she had always done, he would be all set. There was nothing wrong with him. So she managed to get a couple of the detectives working the case. She became very friendly with them. She actually had several, I hate to use the word, sexual relationships with them, but she did. She became involved romantically with a couple of people in order for them to write very friendly recommendations to the reform school to support Jesse's release. In fact, after not even 2 years, he was let go, and he returned to South Boston in the hands of his mother. And he wasn't even 14 years old, and he was back to the detriment of everybody in the community who really did not want him there at all.
And, of course, in your book, we can read then about the murder which he commits of, or we believe, of a young boy named Horace and a young girl named Katie.
Yes.
As you are telling us this story, you are setting it against the backdrop of what Boston was like at this point in time. And as we've already touched on, in the midst of these events is also the extraordinarily devastating Great Boston Fire of 1872. Tell us a little bit more about what occurred with that terrible fire and the way in which it figures prominently in this story.
Well, in November of 1872, the entire downtown area of Boston endured a horrific, a horrific fire, and lots of people don't really know too much about it. The year before, Chicago had had a very devastating fire, so I think people are much more aware of that. But Boston as well, the entire downtown area burst into flames, and it was the place where most of the people had factories, where some people lived as well, but it was the commercial area of Boston. So as soon as that went up in flames, lots and lots of people had damages in the millions of dollars. And the city, it lasted for several days. And the city, as soon as that happened, officials were preoccupied as to how to rebuild. And I think everything that happened that surrounded the city sort of took a backseat to rebuilding. And it was a time when people were managed to get away with lots of things because people were concentrating on rebuilding the city, getting people back to work, building back houses, and trying to find places for people to stay, people to return to work. And Jesse managed to sort of get lost in the shuffle as well.
Hmm. And, of course, he might have gone on killing much longer than he did, except that there were at least a couple of law enforcement officials who made the connection when these when this first body is found of this murder victim, and there were evidently enough similarities to those assault victims from years earlier that somebody made the connection.
They did. I mean, Jesse was very young, and luckily he was not the most sophisticated killer as well. He really didn't pay attention to the clues that he left behind as well, aside from the fact that two people had noticed him running away from the scene as well, and they were able to tell the police about a very tall boy with certain physical characteristics that really matched Jesse as well. As soon as he was caught, the detectives, including Detective Wood, were able to see that Jesse had lots of scratches on his body. He still was wearing the clothes from the time of the killings, and there was blood on it as well. He owned a pair of boots, and they were similar, actually down to the last detail, to the ones, to the footprints that were found on the beaches where the little boy had been found. So there was enough there to connect him to that murder. And it was enough for them to feel that he was precisely. Besides, he confessed at one point, although eventually he recanted, he confessed again. It was a very difficult back and forth between Jesse and the police. In fact, they were very surprised that he could be so devious in speaking to them as well.
Hmm. And of course, even today, we wrestle with what to do with a young person, a young teenager, for instance, believed to have committed terrible atrocities. What does one do with that? Are they to be treated as adults, tried as adults? Do we weigh the fact of their youth? To what extent can we determine the full sanity of someone so young? And we have to remember, too, that we're talking about the 1870s, when there is not as yet anything remotely resembling the more sophisticated understanding we now have of what it means to be mentally or emotionally unsound.
No, I mean, the first thing, as soon as people found out that Jesse had been the one to commit these crimes, Boston and the whole state, they had a pretty good idea what they wanted to do with him, which was to give him the capital punishment. They wanted to drag him. There were many articles that I read of people who simply wanted to drag him to the Boston Commons and hang him, as they had done in earlier times. There was really no empathy or any sadness. There was no idea that perhaps he was mentally ill or that his background had caused him to do that. It was it seemed very simple what to do with him. In many cases, people didn't want a trial at all. They felt that this was a waste of time and money. He had done unto others what should be done unto him as well. So as soon as the trial went on and he was found guilty, he was sentenced to die, although the governor at the time refused to sign the execution warrant, and he lingered on for over a year in jail, waiting to die, which never happened.
Hmm. In fact, he lived out the remainder of his life in what amounted to solitary confinement.
He did. The next governor who came on, he felt after almost 2 years, he felt that something should be done with Jesse. And he felt he was being kind towards him, so he gave him life in prison and to be spent in solitary confinement. And Jesse was still only 16. He was just shy of 17 when he was placed in the state prison in Charlestown, just blocks away from the place where he had lived before he moved to South Boston, and placed in solitary confinement, and where he spent nearly 44 years.
Hmm. We should make sure to mention the fact that in your book, beyond your accounts, and they are detailed accounts of the crimes that were committed and of the trial of Jesse Pomeroy, you also recount the intense interest in the case by two very prominent Americans of the time, Oliver Wendell Holmes and the novelist Herman Melville. Tell us the role which they each played in this story.
Well, they were in the area. Of course, Herman Melville was in the area when the trial was taking place, and he had a deep fascination for everything that dealt with evil and mental illness as well. His own family had a history of mental illness. His father had passed away during a time where it was believed that he was going through some mental disorder as well. His own brother, his grandmother, his child eventually would die during an episode of mental illness. So he had an entire history that he could, I hate to use the word rely on, but look back on and use. And many of his books deal with that subject as well. So, of course, Pomeroy didn't take a genius to figure out that he would be one that he would look into and sort of spark his imagination. For Oliver Wendell Holmes, he was a physician by training. So for him, someone like Pomeroy, he stood out as someone who could be studied, someone who people could learn a lot. And in fact, he tried very hard not to have him committed to a state prison, but to have him placed in a mental asylum where people could study him and learn and see what had really caused him to act out the way that he did. Perhaps they couldn't do anything about it now. It was too late for the children that he had abused and killed. But maybe something could be explained and learned and used for others like him. Of course, no one listened to him.
It's a fascinating thing to even contemplate. And of course, I think your book also does a superb job of painting the picture of the shock and dismay that swept over the whole area of Boston as these crimes were committed, and it really helps put us there, and to imagine if to whatever extent we can. What it would have been like to experience such a thing. In what way do you consider this to be a timely story relevant to us in the year 2015?
Well, we hear about children who commit all kinds of devious, unusual acts to this day. And it seems like the question of why they do the things they do, how could they possibly comprehend the things that they've done, and especially what do you do with them now? So the questions that people were asking in the 1870s appear to be the same ones that we keep on asking today. Why do these things happen? Why do children continue to feel so emotionally empty, if that's the right word, or isolated? did they go on to do such horrific things? And why is it that we don't really learn from the past? Because it seems like we go on repeating the mistakes that we've done in the past, and we continue to do that. Hmm. I mean, back then, the families had no support from one another. Mrs. Pomeroy, she had no one to lean on, knowing that her son had these issues. But today, you know, there are resources, but still, these things continue to happen. So what are we doing to our children that we, in order to help them or not doing? Mm-hmm. So maybe that's the better question.
Mm. The book again is called The Wilderness of Ruin, A Tale of Madness, Fire, and the Hunt for America's Youngest Serial Killer, published by William Morrow, an imprint of HarperCollins. Roseanne Montillo, congratulations on a very, very finely crafted book, and I appreciate you joining me today on the morning show to talk about it.
Thank you very much for having me.
The time is 8:45. You're listening to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTDHD, your gateway to public radio. Now something for on a lighter note for part two of today's program.
Well, depending on who you are and your comfort level in the kitchen, this may be the interview that you should be listening to with special attention. We're talking today with Catherine Alford, who is one of the people responsible for a wonderful new book called How to Boil Water, Life Beyond Takeout. And it comes to us from the kitchens of the Food Network and spins at least in large measure out of a program which frequently airs on the Food Network called How to Boil Water. And as the title perhaps suggests to you, this is both a book and a program designed for those of us that are not particularly comfortable with spatula in hand. Catherine Alford is someone who has written extensively about food, and she has been a very important person with the Food Network, and she oversees the Test Kitchen, which is responsible for many of the recipes that emanate from the Food Network. And she joins us for a few minutes to talk about this new book, again called How to Boil Water, Life Beyond Takeout. Catherine Alford, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, Greg, thank you so much for having me, and I'm so excited about this book. This is our fifth book from Food Network Kitchens, and I have to say I'm the most excited about this one because it's going to bring people into the kitchen. And this is for people who like to eat, but maybe a little, you know, a little scared about getting into the kitchen, and it's the perfect tool to get them cooking.
And I guess that's really been one of the missions of the Food Network all along. I mean that although it has all kinds of programming, including programming designed for fairly sophisticated cooks who are pretty confident and looking for new challenges, a lot of what the Food Network does is designed to make ordinary people feel comfortable in the kitchen.
Absolutely. And everybody wants to get into the kitchen. I mean, everybody eats every day. And this book was really designed as a starting point to get you comfortable and excited about what's going on in your kitchen. And it's full of lots of tips from, like, how to set up your kitchen, what equipment you're going to need, how to go shopping, like, how do you choose fruits and vegetables or in the meat case. And also, of course, it has fantastic, fantastic recipes for American classics like roast chicken or cheesy meatloaf, but also really wonderful global flavors, too. So you might have Chinese baby back ribs or chicken curry. So it's really a large repertoire to get people, you know, cooking and feeding and having a great time.
Tell our listeners what relationship, if any, this book has to the program on the Food Network, which is aired, called How to Boil Water.
Well, Food Network has done How to Boil Water since it went on the air. I mean, actually, Emeril, that was his first show, was How to Boil Water. And we have worked on that show, supported it with Tyler and all the other hosts, and we just know that this is a great title, for one thing, and that this is where people really start cooking, and we just really want to demystify it. And this comes from Food Network Kitchens, the team behind all the chefs, and we did a little survey and figured out how long everyone has been cooking on that team. So that's like over 250 years of culinary experience. So all of that wisdom and expertise sort of got distilled and put into this book.
Now, one thing that I think would make it quite a challenge is that just because somebody is really well-versed in something, I mean, a learned person, whatever the field might be, does not necessarily mean that they're all that good at putting themselves in the shoes of someone who is not experienced or mm-hmm. educated in that field. I mean, for all that expertise that that is in the Food Network kitchens, that doesn't mean you really know what it's like to be standing in the kitchen.
Oh, I hear you.
Baffled.
I know exactly. I mean, that's so, and we really, really looked at that. And one of the things we did is we started this book by first doing a survey and talking to young starting cooks. Like, what is it that you want to learn? What intimidates you? What are the big questions that you want to do? We have a wonderful relationship with our viewers and really listen to them. I also have the perfect example in my own home kitchen. My husband doesn't cook at all. So it was like, honey, what do you think of this? You know, what do you want to learn? Try this recipe. And even the way we wrote the recipes was different than what we've done in the past. We really, like, broke them down and do it step by step and tell you what to do at what point so that you can be successful.
We're speaking with Catherine Alford about the new book from the Food Network Kitchens called How to Boil Water, Life Beyond Takeout. Indeed, the beginning of the book is really interesting as you take us through some really basic stuff but important stuff. In fact, a whole page is devoted just to safety, to the way we handle food and handle utensils and so on. I mean, that's something to think about, especially someone who's barreling right in there.
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's fire and knives and all those things in the kitchen. We want people to feel comfortable and safe when they're feeding their families. And there's tons of how-to pictures. The whole center section of the book is devoted to how to use a knife, how to slice an onion or a tomato or whip cream. So it's like really, really a how-to book, but also it's really fun. I have to say that it's like all the photography will show you what the final dish is supposed to look like and how you get from point A to point B.
One of the items under game plans where you get people actually into the business of cooking is talking about things like timing.
Mm-hmm.
That's where you've really done a good job, I think, because, of course, for an inexperienced cook, they really have no notion of how long it takes for the oven to heat up and that kind of thing, or the way in which the preparation of a meal should logically unfold.
Mm-hmm. We have center sections in the book in between chapters that will be like, you know, what makes a meal? How do I plan a meal? What are the foods that I should combine together? We tried to really look at cooking and food, all the questions that someone might have when they're starting to cook, and also pair that up with, like, really delicious recipes.
Let's talk about the recipes for a moment and what makes these recipes appropriate for a book like this. I mean, did you have certain parameters within which you tried to remain in terms of how complicated these recipes would be?
Yeah, we wanted to make sure that, all recognizable dishes, whether it's lasagna, roast chicken, as we said, toast to turkey, you know, and no recipe was too simple. We do have a recipe for toast, coffee, tea, how to make a smoothie, all breakfast stuff, perfect poached eggs, bacon, all of that, so people have a really great foundation. But also, we know that people have a real taste for global flavors, whether it's Mexican food, making quesadillas or fresh salsa or real guacamole, or also Italian food, whether it's risotto or penne with pasta and pesto. So we really tried to not just American classics, but also global tastes as well. And that really came from our viewers, that they told us one of the top dishes that everyone wanted to learn how to make was chicken curry. And so that's in there, too.
So how complicated are the most complicated recipes here? I mean, some of the recipes fill a page, so they're not all baby simple.
Well, and it may fill a page, but some of that is just really just making very clear instruction. It doesn't mean that it's complicated. It's really supporting someone, and the recipe style in which we wrote them is very conversational. Someone said once it was like having your best friend standing right next to you in the kitchen.
Mm.
And we really respect our audience, and we want to give them good information. So the recipes are easy to do, but chock full of lots of information. And what I also love that we've done with the recipes is we've given suggestions for what we call upgrades. You know, you learn this one basic recipe, like how to saute chicken and make a sauce, and then there's variations that you can do with that. Or you want to make it your own, or you don't have those ingredients in the house, these are great substitutions that you can do for it. So we really wanted this to be like a real great go-to book for people to rely on when they want to cook almost anything.
Hmm. I just, for instance, have your lasagna recipe in front of me.
Oh, it's so funny. So do I.
Yeah. Oh, really? So it's kind of interesting. Like number three, for the lasagna, add the lasagna noodles to the boiling water and cook until al dente. Earlier in the book, you've explained that. Drain, but do not rinse, and lay each noodle out flat on a work surface. I mean, there's just something about that in which you're giving the cook every single thing they need to know.
We really want to support people through it. I always sort of thought of it as it's kind of like dance steps, you know, take one step here, one step there. So it's really, you flow right through it. And we've done, when we do the recipes, the way they're written is really just in that flow and the logic of it. So we've done the thinking, so you can just really have fun making the recipe.
Among some of the interesting tips that are in the book are certain spots that are called Shop Smart.
Mm.
And they represent a really interesting range of advice. Tell us a little bit about what that offers to the reader.
Well, I think Shop Smart is one of my favorite categories in the book, because that's when cooking starts, when you're standing in the store. So we might explain, you know, an ingredient that you might not be familiar with, like five spice powder is a Chinese spice that's used in one recipe that we have. But it also might explain, like, how to choose, you know, fresh fruit and what to look for when buying a melon or a pineapple, some of the questions that people may have, so that when you get into the store, you know what to do.
Catherine Jefford, she is on the staff of the Food Network and one of the editors responsible for this really great book called How to Boil Water, Life Beyond Takeout, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we'll spend part of the hour with Maestro Robert Hasty, the music director of the Kenosha Symphony Orchestra. The Kenosha Symphony, of course, is celebrating its 75th anniversary this year. And their next concert is coming up Saturday night. It's called Our Town, and it features music of Aaron Copland from the film Our Town, as well as from The Tenderland, and also Dvorak's New World Symphony. Maestro Hasty will talk about all three of those works and about the two choirs who are joining the symphony for Saturday night's concert. And on Friday, we look forward to Dr. Art Sear joining us, Clawson Distinguished Professor of Political Economy at Carthage College, director of the Clawson Center there. He joins us on Friday for his monthly visit to the program to offer his analysis of current events, both here and abroad. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived at WGTD.org. Click on Talk. Support for WGTD's Morning Show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenoshans who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. Our weather forecast today for southeastern Wisconsin and northeastern Illinois is for sunny, mild conditions with a high of 60 degrees, partly cloudy overnight with a low of 40. Sunny tomorrow and a high of 63 degrees, a little bit cooler near the lake. On Friday, under sunshine, we should be warming up to 68 degrees. Not quite as warm, but still sunny and very pleasant over the weekend. Close to 60 degrees for a daytime high. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.